campuses.org.
This pot's so good that when I smoke it, the government freaks out.
Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
On this day, June 11th, 1913, the United States General Pershing, who was placed in charge of the U.S. occupation forces in the Philippines, launched an assault on a group of some 500 Filipino Muslims who had sought refuge in the crater of an extinct volcano known as Budbagsak, killing almost the entire group, including many women and children. The Philippine Muslims were among the most determined resistors to the American occupation and were known for their use of suicide attacks, but the Americans in the Philippines were far more brutal, often massacring entire villages and committing other atrocities. There is evidence that Pershing was generally less inhumane than the previous commander in his suppression of the Philippine resistance, but he considered this particular group, which declined all diplomatic overtures and coercion, to be a potential threat, and so no lives were spared. In 1925, more than 3,000 miners went on strike in Cape Breton Island in Nova Scotia against the British Empire Steel Corporation, or BESCO. During the 1925 strike, which effectively shut down the island's entire mining industry, the British-owned power plant shut off services to Cape Breton's entire population. The marchers on this day demanded restoration of services, but the police met them with bullets, and one protester, William Davis, was killed. June 11th is a local holiday in Cape Breton, today known as Davis Day. In 1938, large portions of China were submerged under floodwaters from the Yellow River after the Chinese Nationalist Army deliberately breached levees near the city of Haiyangku 2 days earlier in order to deter Japanese invasion forces during the Second Sino-Japanese War. Residents in the affected areas were not warned of the flood so as to catch the Japanese forces off guard. An estimated 1/2 to 3/4 million Chinese people were killed as a result of the rapidly rising waters, which flooded an area of some 21,000 square miles. And in 1963, the governor of the state of Alabama, noted white supremacist George Wallace, was removed from the doorway of Alabama State University in Tuscaloosa, where he and local state troopers were attempting to prevent two African American students from entering to enroll there. Federal legislation forbade racial segregation in all public institutions and facilities, but Wallace vowed to maintain it in defiance of the law. President Kennedy placed Alabama's National Guard under federal control and ordered them to remove the governor's blockade. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, June 11th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
My name's Mason Tavert. I'm the executive director of SAFER, as well as a co-author of Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink?, which will be available in August. And we work to educate the public about the simple fact that marijuana is far safer than alcohol. And, well, according to a study released today by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, it appears that Coloradans are engaging less frequently in binge drinking and drinking, and more frequently than before in marijuana use. And it's safe to say that more people are using marijuana, fewer people are drinking, and, you know, I have a feeling that there haven't been any serious problems as a result of that. In fact, we wonder if there might we might have avoided some problems, whether some of those individuals who drank opted to use marijuana instead and didn't engage in the troublesome behavior that often accompanies alcohol use. We've been pointing out the fact that alcohol contributes to thousands of deaths, several from overdose. Marijuana has never led to an overdose death in history, and alcohol, particularly here in major cities, leads to countless acts of crime and violence, whether it's bar fights or domestic disputes. More often than not, these incidents involve alcohol use, and more often than not, or virtually never, do they entail marijuana use contributing to the behavior. So it really makes no sense to have laws that essentially drive people to drink instead of using marijuana when they might otherwise prefer to make the rational, safer choice to use marijuana instead. We currently have a campaign going on called the Safer Campuses Initiative, and what we're doing is highlighting the fact that current university and college policies around the nation call for harsher penalties for marijuana use by students than those associated with alcohol use. And essentially what's happening is college students are being told and literally taught to use alcohol instead of marijuana if they want to avoid getting into too much trouble. And obviously alcohol has been a significant problem on college campuses, more so every year. resulting in overdose deaths and fights and rioting even when it comes to sporting events and whatnot. And we've never seen any serious problems associated with marijuana use amongst college students. We simply want schools to stop steering students away from marijuana and toward alcohol by adopting more sensible policies. Information on SAFER is available at saferchoice.org, and if you're a student and interested in getting active at your school, you can visit safercampuses.org.
This pot's so good that when I smoke it, the government freaks out.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathrobs, Piers, Broadsides, with special in-studio guest, Linda Andre. Do I have that right, Linda? Excellent. She's the author of Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment. Stay tuned. Well, we'll see who that is. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, and we're about to begin the show, but let's see who's on the line here first. Hello? Yes, actually, I'm on the air at this time. Let me, have you been in this? Gotcha. I'm receiving instructions here on how to actually run the studio. Thanks, Bob. I'll just pull it out and then deal with it, right? Okay, I'll look for it. My New York visitor is shaking her head, and she's about to leave with a smug look of disgust on her face. Yes, of course we're on the air. I'll talk to you later. That was Skidmark, Bob, in case you didn't know. We would have clued you in on the conversation, listeners, but it might not have been as edifying as well, hearing my side of the conversation, which is always better than both sides. Actually, you're going to hear both sides. I want to introduce my guest to begin with. My guest is Linda Andre. Am I pronouncing that? Andre is right.
Yes.
And Linda, say something so I know we can actually hear you.
Hi, I'm Linda Andre, and I'm thrilled to be in Santa Cruz.
And, of course, excited to be in our clean and sanitary Free Radio Santa Cruz studio with its
I can't comment on
tasteful
that.
Bathroom area. Yes, we won't get into that on the air at this time, folks, but you may send your contributions to Free Radio Santa Cruz, www.freakradio.org, in case you're interested. I'm speaking half humorously, but half seriously. We run on your contributions, so contribute, and our facilities will be upgraded. We won't be driving away our main guests in the future. So, anyway, welcome to Santa Cruz, Linda.
Thank you.
You passed on a copy of your book to me, and I passed some money back to you to pay for it. This is your first book?
Yes.
The name of the book is Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment. How long did it take you to get this sucker published?
Oh, my God. Really, about 25 years.
I mean, from the time you actually completed the writing.
Oh, from the time I completed the writing. It was a couple of years.
And was that because people were skeptical of your research and conclusions because there was a pharmaceutical company knocking at their door and saying, as I heard, for example, with respect to Robert Whittaker's second book, he's the author, those who may not know, of Mad in America, as well as he does a lot of other stuff than analysis of what amounts to psychiatric abuse or pharmaceutical abuse. He tried to publish a follow-up to a famous book of his and had some difficulty persuading his publisher to do it, is what he told me.
Yeah, but I know Robert Whittaker, and we've discussed the book, and he's been helpful to me in getting it published. But the thing about shock treatment, I'm assuming that people know what it is.
Why don't you tell them what this shock treatment is all about?
Shock treatment, also known as electroconvulsive therapy,
ECT.
Or ECT, is a controversial procedure used on people with psychiatric labels in which electricity is shot through your brain to generate a seizure, and then a series of seizures, 12 or 15 or 20. And for very strange, quirky reasons, which I explore in my book, which is a history of shock treatment, this has come to be considered a treatment for mental illness. But the very strange thing about it is shock treatment is not something that could have been invented today. In fact, it only came about under very strange historical circumstances and just thrives not because of science, but because of public relations.
You know, we've heard a lot about, I want to hear about the origins of shock treatment, something about some Italian lunatic in the 30s, are we talking about insulin shock treatment then?
Well, insulin shock was before shock treatment, but those were both back in the day, you know, and mental patients had no rights whatsoever and weren't even considered human. Basically, anything could be done to us, and anything was. And insulin shock was one of those things, putting people into a coma by overdosing them with insulin. And there are all kinds of wonderful other so-called treatments, like putting people to sleep for weeks at a time, or shooting them out with malaria, and shock treatment was just one of them, but shock treatment is the only one that survives today.
You mean the revolutionary and exciting malaria therapy is no longer with us?
Not even lobotomy is still with us, at least in its former form.
Wrapping people up in wet sheets?
No.
Spinning chairs?
No.
Pulling teeth?
We have a high-tech way of doing it now.
Removing body organs?
No.
It's all. You know, the problem with our modern science is they've abandoned the tried and true methods of yore.
I think you're being sarcastic.
I am trying to be sarcastic.
Yes. But, I mean, shock treatment is every bit as bizarre and unscientific as all those other things that they used to do to people. And the amazing thing is that they're still doing it.
So describe for us the new and improved modern-day shock treatments and how they are, what a patient, or should we say a victim, or perhaps a psychiatric survivor, that's a phrase I've heard used. Ex-inmate is another one. You've talked about a couple of things that people who survived psychiatric wards and shock therapy and other treatments use to describe themselves, other labels. But what, give us a kind of, you're you're the ECT patient and you walk in and you're going to get your shock for the, I should say, your series of shocks for the, the month or whatever. What's it all about? How does it proceed? What should you expect? Comfort me, reassure me as I go into this treatment. What am I going to get out of this? How's it going to feel?
You're never going to remember how it feels. I mean, shock treatment erases your memory.
So there'll be no problem. I mean, that's what the doctors say when they put you out with an anesthetic. They say, you're not going to remember anything. And in fact, when you wake up from anesthetics, I've had surgery, I don't remember.
It's shock treatment is not like that. Shock treatment erases just vast swaths of memory, and you never know how much time is going to be erased. Like, I lost 5 years of my life.
What year did you have shock therapy?
84.
And I've read your account, and I recommend folks, if you can't afford the $27 that the hardback costs, or actually probably $30 in California, get it out of the library. I'm going to request that it be carried by the public library.
Oh, yes, but you should buy it if you can.
But she's pushing her book here, folks.
Because, I'm not going to get rich off this thing, but I did spend many years writing it.
And what are you going to do with that money? Are you going to do more surfing? I know you're in Santa Cruz to do some surfing rather than to fight for the rights of our psychiatric inmates.
Well, I like to do both at the same time.
Have you visited Dominican Hospital and taken complaints?
I haven't done that. There I'm not familiar with the area. I just know the beaches. But
have you visited any hospitals in your hometown and taken any complaints?
Not in the sense of taking complaints from individuals, but I have been advocating for people who had shock treatment for the past 25 years.
Have you been successful? I know there's, of course, a big campaign to stop the forced shock of a guy in Minnesota, is it, or Michigan?
This is a very new thing, a new development. The involuntary outpatient shock treatment, something that was not heard of, you know, even a few years ago. But shock treatment, in a sense, is always involuntary. That's one of my main points, because doctors don't tell patients, hence the title Doctors of Deception. What that means is that doctors don't tell people of the known and expected and predictable permanent effects of shock, such as the fact that your memory will be wiped out and will never return, such as the fact that your intellect may be diminished, you may never be the same person, you may lose some of the capacities that made you you, that made you human. You find all this out when it's too late.
You give a very eloquent description of how you were shocked to learn, after you had received the shock treatment, that your IQ had dropped from 150-something down to 112 or something. You saw some objective verification of the fact that abilities that you had prior to shock treatment were gone or diminished because of that.
Yeah.
Has that been replicated with other people that you know?
Yes, absolutely.
And is that documented in your book in terms of, can one go to those original studies there?
They aren't studies, because you have to understand the medical establishment thinks that there is nothing wrong with shock treatment, has never admitted that it causes permanent memory loss, is in total denial and deception about its effects. So nobody is looking to document the long-term adverse effects of shock treatment except people who have had it.
How many of the people would you suggest you've contacted over the years who have at least an interest in seeing this issue further explored, independently of the opinions of physicians, psychiatrists, the pharmaceutical industries, and so forth?
Well, I think everybody who hears of shock treatment has a kind of visceral response to it, even if they've heard good things about it. And when people find out, for instance, that shock treatment has never been investigated for safety the way that drugs are investigated by the FDA, people are, to use a word that I'm going to use a lot, shocked. They cannot believe that this is being done without scientific evidence to prove that it's safe. But in fact, that is the case.
And lawsuits, which you found yourself when you tried to sue the people who involuntarily gave you shock therapy in the 80s?
Yes.
You were unable to do so for a variety of purposes. Doctors wouldn't testify. Lawyers wouldn't take the case and so forth.
Yes. The psychiatric establishment, the American Psychiatric Association, which is the voice of organized psychiatry, has been so successful over the past 30 years or so in convincing everybody that shock is safe. And they have so much perceived credibility that lawyers can't believe that shock could be harmful. Doctors won't believe and can't believe that other doctors are lying about this. Nobody believes that doctors lie. Nobody believes that doctors lie systematically the way they do about shock treatment.
Has there ever been, there must have been a few lawyers who've taken the cases of some people who claim damages from shock therapy just for the money, if nothing else, right?
Money? Well, there would be money if anyone would ever win a case.
I mean, what I'm saying is, I don't know. I mean, you've done research on this. Have there ever been any cases that made it into court because a lawyer said, she may be crazy, but she'll make my day by paying my fee. I'll take her into court if necessary. In other words, did cases ever reach court around shock therapy that you know of?
Oh, yeah.
So there are some lawyers who, for whatever reason, perhaps because they believe it, perhaps because they're simply doing it for the money, have signed on to these cases.
Well, there has never been any money involved because the cases are lost one after the other for various reasons, but the biggest reason being that nobody believes the word of mental patients against the word of doctors.
Have they gone to juries, and have juries made these decisions, or are they stopped short of juries, this claiming damages
for
shock therapy?
I can't speak for every case that's been brought. The first one was brought in 1973, and there have been a lot of cases steadily since then. But, yeah, some have gone to juries. There was a big case in California that went to a jury. That was actually a case against a shock treatment machine company. So they are able to be sued as well as individual doctors. And you know, judges and juries are among the people who have heard something about shock treatment, who have read about it in the media, and come to firmly believe that there can't be anything wrong with it. It must be as they say it is, and this is just not true.
I feel a little bit ill-prepared because, you know, I tried to... You were kind enough to send me chapters of this book, and then I had the problem opening the proper files. And when I actually started reading the book, the first few chapters are really not only informative but extremely moving because they're a personal account of your experiences, which to me often says a lot more. When mixed with relevant data are just, I'm not going to say shocking, but they're certainly, you know, they're not dumbfounding, because I've read this kind of thing before, but some of the things you write I have not seen before, and I'm wondering how many other people that you know of have actually, I mean, I ask you about the community of people who had these experiences and are trying to recover from them, or trying to get some restitution because of them, or trying to make sure that others don't suffer the same fate. And obviously, listeners can understand that I'm no advocate of ECT. I have invited Dr. Fuller Torrey to be on shows in the past. He is, I understand, at least an advocate of drugging and involuntary commitment and involuntary outpatient treatment. And he's a fan of the current psychiatric system, in part, certainly. If not, I don't want to misrepresent what he says. He's with, what's it called, Treatment Advocacy Center or something? In
yes.
Fullerton, California.
Yes.
But, you know, he doesn't come on the show. He replied to me once, but he didn't come on the show with Robert Whittaker, author of Mad in America, Grace Jackson, Jim Gottstein. He isn't interested in talking with these folks, it seems. Could be he's a very busy man. Could be he doesn't have any arguments. Have you ever been able to get into a debate with an advocate and have an intelligent discussion about this issue?
An advocate of shock treatment,
yes.
You mean? You know, that is my fondest wish, that one of them would have the courage to debate me. And so far, that has not happened, but not for lack of trying. In fact, I put out an invitation to Dr. David Healy. I don't know if you know who he is, but he is a shock doctor and a staunch advocate of shock treatment. And he, at first, originally did agree to debate me, but that was before he read my book. And now that the book is out, he simply will not come through on that promise.
Did he say why?
No, he didn't say why. But there's nothing I would like better than to have an honest debate on the issues, on the science, on the evidence, and not these kind of ad hoc, ad hominem arguments that are always made, you know, attacking the messenger instead of the message.
I'm quite familiar with that in Santa Cruz, actually. For myself, too, because I do other kinds of advocacy, and I get arguments about my personal demeanor. But again, I continue to begin to ask a question, and then I veer off. the people that might be and have been, I'm sure, because you're here in on the West Coast at the invitation of you're doing a book tour. You're taking your book to different places. You're going to be speaking at different places to, you know, sell your book and discuss your book and
yes.
hopefully give aid and comfort to those who can learn from your book.
I'll be appearing on Saturday at Book Passage, which is in Corte Madera in Marin County, at 2 p.m. If anybody is in the area, please stop by, and I hope that some psychiatrist will stop by.
You better autograph my book while we're here, of course. Well, you have to. Anyway, go ahead. And you're from New York.
Yes.
And the population of people who might be supportive of this, I've always seen little organizations get together. I mean, I was around in the 70s when Madness Network News was forming in Berkeley, and good publication.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, of course, there's the, what is it, Mind Freedom International up in Eugene, or is it Medford in Oregon?
Yeah, Eugene.
So there are some groups that are you know, that have been fighting. And, of course, I hate to say it because I don't like a lot of the other things they do, but Scientologists don't like psychiatrists either. And I know probably you and I don't. I don't know how you feel about Scientologists. I have a very, very low tolerance for Scientologists and other bizarre mythologies that involve hierarchical structures and ripping people off with large amounts of money. I hope I'm not attacking your religion here.
No. I'm no.
But on the other hand, I think they got some sensible things to say about psychiatry and about the right of people to refuse medication and so forth. What's your feeling about that? Let me just veer off on that particular tangent.
About the right to refuse medication.
Well, about if a Scientologist would defend you, would you feel, you know, embarrassed to be in the same room and head for the exit? Would you say, I agree with you on this issue, although I just don't? Have you had any kind of contacts with them?
I wouldn't feel embarrassed, but I really wrote this book to appeal to a wide audience, not just the core of people who are already converted and already kind of know and believe things that I say. I mean, I wrote this book from an exploration of the scientific literature and the Food and Drug Administration files and all kinds of primary source material that I had available to me from over a period of years. And I really mean it to be read. And a lot of people just dismiss the book as saying, well, how can you call us doctors of deception, or we're not going to read it because it's just against shock treatment, and who are you to be saying these things? But really, you know, the book is meant to be read by a wide audience, and I think that I make my arguments very fairly and very intelligently, if I may say so. And I would like to reach professionals. I would like to reach the general public because, frankly, I think this topic is more interesting than just a history of shock treatment, though that is also very interesting to me because I had it. But it's also about, you know, why we believe what we believe, how we come to our conclusions, who we trust. You know, can we trust the media? Should we question what doctors say? Should we listen to the FDA, the APA, NIMH, the Surgeon General? Should we just believe things that these people say, or should we look deeper? Should we do our own thinking? Should we do our own digging? Should we make our own conclusions? And that's really what it's about. That's what I hope to get people to do.
Hard to do if you can't get the other side to come forward. What about people who've had shock therapy and say to you, hey, this helped me out? Although it's hard for me to remember anybody who actually came to me and said that.
Well,
but
it's hard for people who had shock therapy to remember anything. And that's what you find. You get some people like Kitty Dukakis, who, you know, got money to write a book praising shock, which was at the suggestion of her shock doctor, Charlie Welch. Even she says, I can't remember. I can't remember this trip I took. I can't remember things I did. Michael, her husband, had to tell me about our trip to Paris. But she says it in such a way as if it's no big deal. Well, you know what? It is a big deal. When you lose your memory, it is a big deal. When you can't remember what you did or people you knew or books you read or things you studied, it is a very big deal. So there are people who will come and say, shock treatment helped me, but there are two things. They will always say, it's temporary. Look at Kitty Dukakis has to go keep getting shock treatment once every few months. She keeps going in for more. Why? Because it doesn't last very long. And she has permanent memory loss. So, yeah, there are people who will accept the permanent memory loss and who will keep going in for it. But those people are the exception because most people value their memory and they value their intelligence.
So shock treatment, I haven't read all the positive accounts, although I've seen some of the propaganda in Time. I think Time magazine did a spread recently, last couple years on this.
They keep recycling these stories over and over and over.
The theory, the basic claim is that it helps people who are depressed. And that because, I guess the theory is, I'm not sure whether it's a biochemical theory or we destroy your memory so you can't remember why you're depressed, so now suddenly you're happier. Give us the shock docs theory of why you should go get shocked if you're depressed.
The very interesting thing is they don't have a theory. The first thing they will tell you is, we don't know why it works. And they've had some pretty bizarre theories over the years about why it works. But they will come out and say, we don't know why it works. We can't explain it. We keep trying to figure it out and we can't. Well, there's a very simple explanation for why it works, because it produces brain damage. And not many people know this, but if you have acute brain damage, it looks a lot like shock treatment. You can't remember things. You're kind of cheerful. You are not perturbed by things that used to be bothering you. You're just kind of almost exhilarated in a way with organic brain syndrome, which is what happens with brain damage. It's the same thing that happens with shock treatment, except in a mental hospital they call that improvement.
But organic brain damage actually leaves behind, presumably, physical evidence of damage, whereas do you have any evidence of physical damage that's happened to you or to others as a consequence of shock therapy? You have evidence of loss of capability, loss of memory, loss of personality, which are all real things and perhaps even more important than these other things. But technically, in terms of actual organic brain damage, presumably is something that's, as a physical correlate, right?
Yes, but the psychometric tests are a way of measuring that. That's one of the ways that they diagnose brain damage. They look at what you can do and what you can't do, and they say, this could not have happened any other way except through acquired brain damage. Now, there are also tests that you can do, such as MRIs, but none of the so-called scientists who study ECT and get money to research it are doing those kinds of studies because they don't want to know the answers to those questions.
So you don't really have an answer for me, I'm being the devil's advocate here, as to whether there's actual proof of real organic brain damage.
If you go looking for it, you will find it.
You have found it? You have a study you can cite for us, or it's in the book somewhere?
Nobody is doing these kinds of studies because the guys that get money to do the studies won't do them.
That may be, but the answer is no, I have no evidence.
No, that's not exactly true.
Okay, go ahead.
For example, there's one study that was done by a man who has been taking money from the shock machine company Mecta since the 70s, since it started. Okay, he's the lead author. So already you've got a conflict of interest. What they do is they take people who've had shock already, and then they shock them again, and then they compare them to themselves the first time, which is not a scientific study because you're comparing the effects of shock to the effects of more shock.
Compare in the sense of behavioral behavior?
No, I mean with brain scans. I'm talking about the only MRI studies that have been done.
I'm not an expert on brain damage. If you present someone with organic brain damage to a doctor, can he, through various tests which don't involve behavior, independent behavior, tell that there's organic brain damage?
Yes.
And have these tests been performed on people with shock therapy?
Yes.
And have they found the same kind of damage of that sort? In other words, I'm looking for a physical indication.
Yes, the answer is yes.
And that's in your book?
Yes.
Okay.
Should have read it.
I only had a day. I'm not a speed reader. Besides, it was so interesting, I had to take it little by little. It was, I did. It was... I made a lot of notes in the areas that I did read.
Good.
Some notes. We're talking with Linda Andre, Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, www.freakradio.org is where we're at. And you can call in, even you, Jim Gottstein, if you're listening up in Alaska and you feel like calling in and making a commentary. Just don't take up the whole show with your commentary, but do call in if you'd like. Jim, of course, as you may have heard, has won a successful case, or he did a couple of weeks ago, which requires that, I guess, I'm kind of winging this, that people get in, that if they want to hold you involuntarily and drug you, they have to, the authorities involved have to meet a series of conditions involving showing it's the least invasive therapy, showing you what the side effects are, a series of informed bits of information that hopefully will give. It's not just a blank, the doctor says it's a good idea, and the judge says, oh, okay, away we go. Have you studied that decision that he's made?
I haven't studied it. I've heard about it.
Yeah. So I'm interested in how that's going, and of course, if you're listening, Jim, and you want to call in, you can. Other people are also welcome to call, and the call-in number here is 831-427-3772. However, what I'm going to do right now, because I've been peppering you with questions, is give you a chance to make a statement of your own about the most important things you think people need to both draw them to buy this book, or at least to read this book if they can't afford it, because most of my audience can't afford this book. You know, most people I've talked to on the we're talking to people who have enough money, who can't afford, you know, a room for the night. So they're not going to be able to spend $30 on a book. But they may need to know what's in this book, because they may be the people that, at least in Santa Cruz, there's not that much shock going on. But it goes on over the hill, I believe, in California. There is shock going on here in California.
Yep.
What should people take away from this book that you want to pass on now?
Well, if you're talking about people who might ever seriously be considering shock treatment or have shock treatment recommended for them or forced upon them, or somebody whose family member has been recommended for shock treatment, which is certainly a big audience for this book, people need to know that shock treatment always has permanent adverse effects on memory and cognition, and the only variables are how much you're going to lose, how much time is going to be erased, and what abilities that you will lose permanently. Right now, doctors tell people that shock treatment is harmless, that there has never been permanent memory loss from shock treatment. They discount everybody who reports permanent memory loss from shock treatment as crazy. Hey, if you weren't crazy, why'd you get shock treatment? It's kind of a catch-22 situation. But if doctors were being honest, and this whole book is a plea for doctors to be honest, though it's very pessimistic about that possibility, people should know that you're trading permanent adverse effects of shock treatment for possible temporary alleviation of whatever your problems were, your symptoms were, but that it doesn't last. And a lot of people probably wouldn't consider that a good trade-off to make, but some people might. But I think, you know, the bigger question is this something that doctors should be offering patients? Is this a moral thing for doctors to be offering patients? Is this a moral thing for society to be allowing? And I don't know of any other book on shock treatment that asks that question. But I have a chapter where I look at that and try to place it in context and reason about it the way we reason about other moral issues. And I come to the conclusion that it's not.
Well, don't most people who are survivors of psychiatry have that opinion anyway, even if they haven't been shocked? I mean, it's hard to find advocates of shock treatment. I mean,
well, among professionals,
is the only one you've been able to cite so far. I'm afraid you're not doing a very good job of advocating for the other side here.
Well, if a patient, ex-patient, is willing to sing the praises of shock treatment, they will get publicity. They will get a book contract without having to go through what I went through. They will get on television. They will get in the media. But those aren't representative people who've had shock treatment, as
you
said.
Now, you're getting in the media, the minor media.
You call this the media?
The mini media, perhaps. The pirate media, maybe. Which has questionable bathroom facilities. But, you know, I mentioned to you, I mentioned on the air at the beginning of this, that I thought I was really struck by your first chapters. You mentioned you were awarded a National Merit Scholarship to New York University, became a photographer, exhibited at the age of 20, discovered a talent for writing photographic theory and criticism, published scholarly articles, and that is all you remember about your life up to age 25. You don't remember.
Well, some of that I don't remember. It's just what I know. I mean, I didn't lose my entire memory. I just lost those about 5 years. But they were very important 5 years. I would never have chosen to lose them. I would never choose to lose the worst years of my life. It wasn't my choice. And that's why people feel so strongly about shock treatment, because we had this taken from us against our will. It wasn't our choice. We weren't given that choice. And patients are never given that choice, which is why I say it's not moral for a civilized society to be offering this to people, no matter what benefits are claimed.
Have any friends who are psychiatrists?
Actually, yeah.
Have any friends who are shock docs?
No.
Do you have any friends who are in the middle who are psychiatrists? Who might recommend people to go to shock docs?
Do I have any friends that would recommend shock treatment to people?
Any friends who are psychiatric professionals who would do that?
No.
What I'm trying to understand is, again, I'm looking for this dialogue that you're looking for.
Oh. You know. Well, I could tell you what they would say. I mean.
Because you've talked to them, or because you've read their writings?
Because they tend to say the same things over and over. They say, it works. It works. That's always the argument that psychiatrists make, as if that trumped everything else. But in fact, that's not even true, that it works. And that's not even true by their own research, if you look at the research studies that they've been done. There's very few studies that even look at efficacy of shock treatment. And yet this kind of myth has arisen. You know, it works. It works 80%, 90% of the time. Where'd they get those figures from? They made them up. They don't exist. There is actually a very large study in 2006, I think it was, where they looked at about 300 people who had shock treatment, and they looked at the so-called success rate, or how much the shock treatment alleviated the symptoms they came in with. And the actual rates were just more like 30% than 80% or 90%, that's been claimed.
Symptoms being mainly depression?
Mostly depression, yes.
Somebody comes to you and says, my son is depressed and suicidal. You've heard this story before, I'm sure.
I have.
He wants to, you know, his doctor recommends shock therapy because all these wonderful combination of drugs we've tried, locking him in a room and telling him he's a bad boy, don't work. What do you recommend instead?
See, that is not a question I can answer, because if something is unscientific, if something is immoral, if something is doing more harm than good, I don't have to say I have to come up with an alternative.
No, of course you don't. But it's a human reality, too.
Oh, I get that all the time. What would you do instead? And people don't like to think that there might be nothing, or in fact that doing nothing might be better than doing something.
That's an honest answer.
Because we as a society think it's always better to do something than to do nothing, and a lot of times it's not.
In other words, in fact, it's been World Health Organization figures have been cited by Robert Whitaker in his book Mad in America, claiming that third world countries that simply allow people to go through so-called schizophrenic or manic depressive or psychotic episodes without forced medication. I don't think it gets into ECT much, but
no.
Forced medication end up much better than folks who are, you know, constantly drugged or drugged and then stop the drugs. And in Western societies, both here and in the U.S., I mean, in Europe.
Yeah, and there is research that shows that most depressions, major depressions, resolve within 6 months without any treatment at all. And I would also add, this is very important, that people always say, well, if you don't shock these people, they will kill themselves. Well, let's look at what the research actually says. This is their research, the doctor's own research, on ECT and suicide, or ECT and mortality. And I looked at those studies for the book. And in fact, they do not show evidence that ECT prevents or has ever prevented anybody from committing suicide. So once again, this is one of the big myths about ECT, one of the big lies, if you will, that it keeps people from killing themselves. Because when they go looking for the evidence to show that that's true, they can't find the evidence. If anything, it's on the other side, that people who have had shock are more likely to commit suicide.
Is there an online site? I know you work with the Committee
for Truth in Psychiatry.
And does that have a website?
No, we don't have a website.
Get with it, Linda.
Well, I don't know how to do a website. But
we can find somebody who might help you do a website.
The book has a website, doctorsofdeception.com,
mm-hmm.
and Committee for Truth in Psychiatry, though it does not have a website, is the oldest national organization of psychiatric survivors in this country. It was founded in 1984, so that makes it older than any other national organization that still exists. But given that the mission of this group is to advocate for truthful, informed consent for shock treatment, support has not been forthcoming from any state offices of mental health or the federal government.
Strangely
or foundations.
Enough.
I don't know why, but yeah, so basically...
How about Scientologists? Have they put in some grants for the group?
No.
Scientology has long had an opposition to psychiatric interventions of this kind. So they're older than your organization, and
Scientology is not an organization of psychiatric survivors. We are only people who had ECT.
Okay, but they are an organization that is consistently opposed.
The CCHR, which is kind of separate from Scientology.
What does that initial stand for?
Oh, CCHR, Citizens Commission on Human Rights, is kind of the anti-psychiatry wing of Scientology, but it's not the same as Scientology.
Are they supportive of you and vice versa in terms of research into these issues?
Well, they are very opposed to shock treatment and very interested in doing something about it any way they can.
So, I guess that answers my earlier question. The tone in your voice indicates that you might not have, a lot in common with Scientologists otherwise, but this particular group, which is somewhat independent of, but probably not that independent of Scientologists, is something that you share some common objectives with.
Well, I talk in my book about how, rather than discuss whether shock treatment actually causes brain damage or what the evidence on it is, people will attack the messenger. And I get a lot of people accusing me of being a Scientologist as a way of trying to discredit me.
We put that aside because obviously that's a bunch of horseshit, frankly. I don't want to waste any time on that, although I'm sure you have to waste a lot of time on that. But
they never fail to bring that up, never.
Right, but I bring it up for a different reason because I like to see common objectives, even between organizations with divergent points of view on other things. I mean, that's what I people work in the homeless civil rights movement who are fundamentalist Christians who I completely disagree with on other issues. But in terms of the rights of poor and homeless people outside, we do agree. And we try to, I like to see coalitions for me. I know a guy in Southern California called Wiley Drake. He's a reverend, he's a Republican. He's, he wants to save the gays and all this stuff. A big buddy of former President Bush and all that sort of thing. But he's also a man who stood up to the police when they tried to remove homeless people from his church or who are parked nearby, go after homeless people in vehicles in his town of Buena Vista. He has refused to close down his meal for homeless people, even though they went in and convicted him of a misdemeanor for that. So, you can form strange coalitions on these issues. And you need all the allies you can get, and I guess at least you got this thing published. It took you, say, a number of years after it was finished. You took this manuscript around from...
It took me a long time to write it, and then it took me a long time to find a publisher.
How many publishers rejected it?
a lot.
A dozen, 100?
More than a dozen, but less than 100.
And what kind of reasons did you get for the initial rejections of this manuscript?
Well, they don't always give you reasons, but one of the presses that was kind of the runner-up for this book, basically what they are saying to me was, we just cannot believe that things are as bad as you say they are. More or less.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people have trouble. It's very threatening to people to think that you might not be able to trust doctors, that you might not be able to trust organized medicine, that you might not be able to trust your government. So such as the Food and Drug Administration, to protect you against medical devices and drugs that are harmful. I mean, that is the fact, but a lot of people cannot handle that fact.
ECT in the military, what's the story? Has there been much invasion of military services with shock therapy?
See, now you ask me something that I can't answer.
Well, maybe next time you come on, you'll have an answer for that. Because that's a huge, I mean, I think one of the main reasons for this, I mean, I'm sure one of the reasons the psychiatrists blew this is because they think it helps.
Well, they have a whole different perspective on what help is.
Right,
you know,
of course.
Their job is like the immediate thing of this person is acting and saying and doing all these things that are, you know, distressing, and they want that to stop. But you, in the act of making that stop, you can create long-term damage that's much worse.
Sure. And I was actually, there was a conclusion to that sentence.
Okay.
Which is, but there's also a lot of other powerful factors involved, like profit-making.
Yes.
That's what I want to ask you about. How much profit does a doctor or a hospital or the organization, you know, whatever the business is that people who make these machines, how much does it cost to do one of these sets of ECT? Do you know what the costs are?
I'm not sure for each treatment or each individual course of treatment how much it is, but you know, when I had it, that was quite a long time ago. I believe it cost $25,000, so that would be quite a lot more now. My fellow author, Leonard Frank, who wrote The History of Shock Treatment, which is a book that came out in 1975 on the history of shock treatment, and I pick up after 1975 mostly. But anyway, he came up with a figure in the 90s of $5 billion a year for shock treatment for the entire...
Is that an accurate figure, or is he some sort of lunatic who's trying to attack our psychiatrists?
He's extrapolating from, I guess, the cost of individual treatments at that time and how many people we think get it. We don't even really know how many people get it.
You mentioned you think 2 or 3 million people have been...
We don't know. We don't have statistics. We don't have reporting of statistics on ECT, except in 7 states, of which California is one. But for the most part, there are no national figures. These people can make up any kind of figure they want, and they do.
What about California? Over the last... Is the use of ECT rising, falling, and how, if it's rising, how much? Give us the idea in the last 20 years where it's been going.
Well, I haven't looked into the California statistics, but I was just speaking with people who have tried to get the figures in recent years in California, and they say that they have great difficulty and have not been able to get the statistics, and that just because the state is required to keep statistics does not mean they're required to release them to people who want to know.
I don't know about that. There's sunshine laws in some areas, and California does have a Freedom of Information Act, or a Public Records Act, actually. Freedom of Information Act, I think, is a federal law. It's an interesting question. What about New York? New York, you're from New York.
We don't have any reporting of statistics in New York. We're about to bring back a law that would require that for the third try, but the first two times it was defeated. And again, it has to do with the power of organized psychiatry, the American Psychiatric Association, the local psychiatric associations. They are passionate about shock treatment. They see that as like their last bastion. You know, they've got to have that. If they don't have that, that's their last resort. That's their big gun. That's what they bring in when the drugs don't work and nothing is working, and then they sell it to people. It's their last resort. They've got to have that.
But we don't know what the figures are in California.
No, we don't.
Even though they are kept.
Yeah.
What agency keeps them?
You would try to contact the patient's rights office. I'm not sure exactly what it's called in Sacramento. I know I have tried to do this, and I have given up because it wasn't happening. But
well, you got to get Jim Gottstein or some California equivalent behind you to sue them to death.
But imagine a world in which it's like radical to even keep track of how many people get shock. That's considered a radical idea. That's why those bills are defeated, not only in New York State, but many, many other states have brought bills like that, and they've been defeated.
No need to imagine, I guess. The future is here now. We're talking with Linda Andre, author of Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment, this is your chance to grill this woman, if you'd like, and make sure, and pierce through her the maze of paranoia she's trying to throw up against our poor shocked docs. Phone number here is 427-3772. And if you want to call in, maybe you get your own experience with shock therapy. Although I think for a lot of people, there's a stigma attached to this, right? People don't want to say, by the way, I'm crazy. I've been shocked. And don't hire me anymore. And don't rely on my opinion on anything. And everybody should know that I'm a lunatic. And so you, on the other hand, have said, you've gone through this phase, I'm sure, where people, you've mentioned it in your book.
Yes.
They don't believe you. They don't, you know.
I don't. Not only went through it, but it never ends.
And are you coming out of it? Have you reached a point where when you lie in your bed at night, you can say, fuck this shit. I'm not crazy. They are. Meaning, people who consciously make profit and claim to be helping other people through shooting them up with electricity or toxic medications have a kind of insanity about them. I mean, they may be fine people in other respects, but to me, it's insane behavior on a number of levels because it doesn't accomplish the purpose. It is profoundly uncompassionate. As you say, it violates ethical standards. And it's done to some extent for profit.
Yes. And as I say over and over again in the book, there is no science behind it. There's just this public relations campaign that's kind of a jingoism that's repeated over and over. Well, shock treatment, you know, it's new and improved. Now we know how to do it and doesn't erase your memory and we've got it all down now. But that's just not true. If you look at the actual science, if you look at the research that's been done and not done, it tells a very different story.
And again, I'm looking at your book for those who you can go online and check out Doctors of Deception by Linda Andre, published in
2009 by Rutgers University Press.
Wow! And how many people did you have to seduce to get this thing published at Rutgers?
None.
Excellent. And why do you think Rutgers decided to publish this?
Oh, I have my speculations on that, but I don't.
Did you call in a few favors? Is that what happened?
I don't know if I want to make that public.
We're going to have to investigate this off air, folks. We'll get into this. So you actually came and spoke to MH Can today at 3. That's a local group of psychiatric survivors. Did any NAMI people, National Association of the Mentally Ill, stand up and denounce you as an alarmist?
I wish.
No?
Unfortunately, no.
Have you ever gone into NAMI meetings and just sort of, ask a question of the latest shock doctor?
Yeah, and also APA meetings,
NAMI, too. By the way, tell us a little about NAMI, which is probably one of the most powerful organization of essentially friends and relatives of people who've been labeled mentally ill, right?
Yeah, mostly parents. Well, I don't think that NAMI ever met a treatment or a doctor that they didn't like, and they're very, very pro-medical model, and they're very defensive of shock treatment. And it was NAMI in New York State who convinced our governor not to pass a bill requiring reporting of shock statistics.
What reasons did they give for that?
There weren't any real reasons. There were only smokescreen reasons. They said it would compromise patient confidentiality and that it would stigmatize a valuable treatment. But, of course, those weren't the real reasons.
The real reasons were that you think it might have shown that it wasn't as effective as it was claimed to be.
Well, if there's no statistics, you can make up anything that you want to say. But if there are statistics, then you can't.
And some of these statistics you found are... And you've tried to bring together in the notes in this book?
Mostly the fact that there aren't any statistics. For instance, the fact that there's this claimed comeback of shock treatment. Have you heard about that one?
I've seen it on Time magazine.
Oh, it's been this started in 1979. And what I did was I went through my whole vast collection of articles and just picked out these comeback of shock treatment. And they've just been repeated over and over. The first one was in 1979. It's 2009. How can something be making a comeback for 30 years? That doesn't make any sense.
Sounds like kind of a PR campaign.
How can you be saying the same thing over and over and people don't realize because every time they hear it, it's the first time they hear it. But when you write history, you get to look at these things and see how they've developed over time, and you get to see that these articles are repeating over and over and over.
Have you ever been able to get any psychiatric survivors who are critical of ECT shock treatment been able to get on alternative media in any meaningful way, like, I know Amy Goodman does Democracy Now.
Amy Goodman.
Has Amy done a...
Amy!
Amy's been in our studio, folks.
Amy!
So
I want to come.
Hasn't taken me.
I want to come on. Can I come on your show?
So have you asked to come on the Goodman Show with your book?
I'm asking her right now.
She's not listening to my show. Nobody listens to my show. Here. We don't get any call-ins. Nobody writes. It's a sad situation. But we are archived. For those of you who are listening who just tuned in, we're talking with Linda Andre, author of Doctors of Deception. And in case you find any of this interesting and worth reviewing, you can go to www.huffsantacruz.org and look up the name of my show, which is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And you can hear the whole thing from beginning to end, the last hour that we've been talking. Now, at the beginning of the hour, I offered you an escape. At some point, we're going to open the door very briefly for a few moments in case you wish to scuttle out. After that, of course, the door will be closed for the rest of the night and you're going to be doomed. But what I do now is I'm going to turn to, assuming I can make the appropriate connections and the equipment, some local civil rights action, which, who knows, you might find it of interest to comment on, you might not. And who knows, again, call-in number here in case you're listening and you want to call in is 427-3772, 427-3772. I have not read the full book.
I think you left out something really important, actually.
What did I leave out?
Well, like chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11. I'm talking about the chapters where I talk about the Food and Drug Administration's involvement with ECT. That's been a huge story, and it's a big part of this book, and I don't think a lot of people know
Summarize
that.
Summarize it for us.
Okay, well, the FDA regulates medical devices, and the shock machine is a medical device. And when they were given the authority to regulate shock devices back in 1976, then there was the possibility that the FDA could conduct a scientific safety investigation of the effects of shock on the brain, or it could not. And the APA lobbied. American Psychiatric Association was on the ball lobbying the FDA not to investigate shock treatment. And on the other side was people who had survived ECT and just about everybody else in the world. In fact, that's how the Committee for Truth in Psychiatry came into existence as an official formal organization, was to have an organization to lobby the FDA.
And you mentioned one of the founders, I believe, in your book?
Yeah, a woman named Marilyn Rice, who actually used to work for the federal government and whose career was ended by shock treatment, and she was kind of pissed about that. And she spent the rest of her life trying to advocate for informed consent, truthful informed consent. In other words, people being told what shock treatment will do to their memories. Now, she wasn't successful, but she gave the FDA a very hard time. I don't think they ever saw anything like her before or after. So she organized a campaign to get people who had survived ECT to write in to ask for a scientific investigation.
Her name again?
Marilyn Rice. And people did, and this was a battle that raged on for over 20 years, and in fact has never even stopped. But the interesting thing is that everybody in the world pretty much was on the side of doing a scientific investigation, because why wouldn't you want that?
Well, marijuana is the same problem, as you know. I mean, everybody wants to do scientific investigations of marijuana, except, of course, the huge, powerful interest groups that keep it illegal.
Oh, I guess it's kind of the same thing.
I think it has a similar.
Yeah.
There may be a yes.
But there was such an outpouring of just regular people writing to the FDA, and I know this because I went to their archives and I read the letters that people had written, and that some of them are in the book, and they're just heartbreaking letters, you know, from people who've had shock.
But it didn't break the heart of the FDA.
The FDA didn't. FDA. No, I don't have a heart. Basically, they've always sided with the American Psychiatric Association, and they actively refuse to investigate ECT. Now, the thing is that they just recently admitted this by a kind of convoluted way. They decided to clean up their act on all the medical devices that were in the Class 3 high-risk category.
Such
and,
as?
These are things like, I don't know, I'm not sure what the other ones are, but Class 3 devices were never investigated for safety. They were grandfathered in, and so they never had to go through any testing. And just recently, FDA announced that it is starting to require testing for these all these devices, one of which was the ECT device. And when the media picked up on this admission by the FDA that it had never tested these devices,
what year
people
was this?
Since 1976 till
when,
now.
But when did this admission?
Just April 8th of 2009.
Wow.
Yeah, so 33 years they let this device be used without any evidence, not one shred.
It's an experiment. We're just finding out.
An experiment on a generation of people, yeah. And now they're saying we're going to ask the manufacturers to submit safety information, but they're not going to because they can't, because they don't have any, because their treatment and their devices are not safe.
Is there a schedule of hearings on it? Is it actually being researched now, or is this something that can be easily covered up again and buried?
Well, if people don't pay attention, they have given these manufacturers, and there are only two of them in the United States, they've given them until August of this year as a deadline to submit their safety studies. But they're not going to submit anything because they don't care what the FDA says. They've never paid any attention to the FDA whatsoever, and they've got the American Psychiatric Association behind them. So they're not going to submit anything. And then the question is, what's going to happen? Is the FDA just going to let them slide once again? Because the FDA should take the shock machines off the market once the manufacturers don't submit.
Has that been done in any other countries?
Well, I don't know what there is that's similar to the FDA in other countries.
I mean, not so much the FDA, but what's the fate of shock treatment in other countries? Is it any different than the U.S.? Is there more of it? Is there less of it?
I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, shock is used all over the world and in many places. It's often used unmodified, that is, without anesthesia still. What they call the old shock is still being used in countries like Japan. I mean, modern countries use unmodified shock treatment.
Are there countries that have become particularly alarmed about it and don't use it?
Well, Italy has banned the use of shock treatment.
Really? And why did they do that?
I'm not sure all the details. It had to do with kind of a larger movement that was concerned with violations of human rights in psychiatry. So I don't have all the details
we
on that.
We will
but
be
that
expecting
is,
a full review
well,
in our next meeting, your next book, I should say.
Slovenia banned shock treatment.
Slovenia, Italy.
And some parts of Switzerland.
And some cantons in Switzerland.
Exactly.
French-speaking cantons, perhaps?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Je ne sais pas. Well, I'm going to take a musical break. You've been listening to Linda Andre, who is may stay with us for longer or may disappear. I don't know what's going to happen to Linda. You can actually encourage her to stay longer by actually showing that somebody's listening out there. 427-3772 is the call-in number. Give a call, and we'll answer, and we'll talk back at you. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrop Spears Broadside. The name of the book, Doctors of Deception. The name of the author, Linda Andre. And the organization she works with, the Committee for Truth in Psychiatry?
Yes.
It sounds like a kind of a, what they call it, jumbo shrimp, a misnomer.
Yeah.
Yeah, litotes. I don't know what the word is for this, but in any case, one of those strange contradictions of words juxtaposed together. Let's have a little music, and I'll be back. 427-3772.
learning to live. So close to the fire, don't get burned. Dream like a child, try to live like a saint. Still holding your hand, haven't you learned?
Actually have a caller. I believe it's Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
And Sam, you got a question? You got a comment?
Well, yeah, I was just, it might be too personal, but I was just wondering what were the reasons behind the shock treatment that Linda received.
Go ahead, Linda.
Or, I mean, you don't have to.
Well, Linda actually writes about it in her book.
Yeah.
Well, I bought the book today. I was there at MH Can.
So. Oh, hi there.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, it's all in the book. Everybody go read the book. But I got locked up because of a family member, and I'm sure that if I hadn't been involved with this family member, none of this would ever have happened. But see, I don't remember what was going on with me. I mean, I have some ideas and speculations about what was going on with me, but nobody else can really tell me. I'm pretty sure that I was feeling bad and that I got labeled depressed. But I'm not quite sure why or what was going on with me. But
did you agree to it, or was forced treatment, or?
Well, I mean, there's many ways of forcing treatment, such as shock, on people. You don't always have to go to court, though. That's one way of doing it. But coercion works just as well.
Right.
So I was coerced and threatened, and given no choice. Actually, if I knew then what I know now, I probably would have fought it. I probably would have lost, but I would have tried. But they convinced me that I had no chance.
By coercion, they said, if you don't agree, we're going to take you to court.
No, they said, if you don't agree, we're going to lock you up and throw away the key.
Ah. Well. With bad psychiatric food, I suppose.
That must have really hurt that a family member did this to you. You must have really... gone through, like, you know, emotions of, like, you know, well, this person was in my family and I trusted them, and like, should I still trust them or not? Or, I mean, because you were probably pretty young at the time, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I no longer consider that person a family member.
Right.
And, you know, he, to this day, believed the doctors. And he goes along with this idea, well, I was just doing what they said to do, and he doesn't take personal responsibility for it.
Yeah.
But a lot of people do that. It's a very safe thing to do. Well, I'm just doing what the doctor said.
Yeah, some people, I think that's something that that people really don't talk about in the mental health system is that that a lot of doctors are really, like, into control, and family members, that people that you trust, and can be very much into control too, you know,
right.
Like they want to, like, you know, decide something because they're so out of control, they feel like they need to, try and control someone else. So.
Right, and they can also have their own motives that don't have your best interest at heart, which is the case with me.
Right. Anyway, I'm going to read the book. Just want to call in and, offer support that it was an interesting talk, both at MHCAN and on the radio, and I think it's going to be a good read. So, but I'm glad somebody's writing about this, and I'm also glad that this radio show is there. So,
thanks, Sam.
I will talk to you some other time.
Hey, call back anytime.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. And where can people get this book locally? Is it available at different bookstores?
I would walk into your local bookstore and demand that they stock it, because that actually works. I mean, a lot of books
That's true. You can get it. Yeah, I mean, I go to the Capitola Book Cafe, and I go and I ask for books. They don't let me into the bookshop Santa Cruz, because it's run by the Coonerties, and there are political figures in Santa Cruz that I've rather strongly disagreed with, and they've come to the conclusion I'm persona non grata, but you aren't. If you can go into the Bookshop Santa Cruz, you can go into the Capitola Book Cafe, Logos, ask for Doctors of Deception by Linda Andre.
And of course, it's available online, too.
Or you could actually write Linda and say, hey, send it to me. I don't know. I'm not sure what you'd do if somebody wrote you a letter with a check in it.
I'd send them a book.
You'd see? So there you are. Once she learns how to use the Internet properly. It sets up the appropriate website. Actually, there is a website for your book, Doctors of Deception,
right,
by Linda Andre. I am going to continue this discussion. I'm going to have more questions of Linda if she's here. We'll see if she remains. But first, I'm going to play a little street interview or two so that we can hear the voice of people who are underrepresented. They don't get to write books. Fly from New York to California or California to New York, even if it's on their own money, because much less even sometimes drive or even hitchhike. In any case, here's a little from... we've been doing some organizing around the issue of people who are being excluded from Jack's Hamburgers. You may remember... we've talked about this on the air. I would say it's pretty wonderful. Agreement was reached where people who had been excluded were let back in again. The code of conduct was made clear. And clean slate was established. Thank you, Connie Hutchinson, for doing that. Hope I have your name right. So we began to organize more broadly, some of us. And this is an organizing session that happened with some unfortunate consequences, but some positive consequences, on the lawn of Calvary Episcopal Church about a week and a half ago. And I believe that's the tape I have on now. Let's see if we're actually going to hear it. And Linda, if you have any commentary at any point, please signal me, and we'll talk. And, of course, phone number here is 427-3772.
So it's about 5 to 4. We're here across from the Nickelodeon on the lawn of the Calvary Episcopal Church talking with...
Christina.
Christina, it's Monday, the 1st of June. June is busting out all over, and you say a church official has told you that not to loiter prior to the Cavalry Coffee House, which is supposed to start in an hour or two.
Yes, yeah. It should happen soon. So he told me I could wait because I said I was waiting for some friends.
I see, but he initially wanted you not to loiter.
Not to loiter, yes. Yep. He also kicked a bunch of other kids out. But
how many kids were told to leave?
There are two groups, about five or six each.
And what about this? You said there's a couple with a baby over here? I didn't see the baby.
Yeah, there's a couple with a baby, and he didn't ask them to leave. But.
Well, maybe you need to just have a child. Now, I could suggest
yeah.
a number of men who might
or
be willing to.
If I was homeless and had a baby, maybe then I could stay, but, you know.
Well, you could consider that as a very viable option.
And the point here was that the couple with the child was not a homeless-looking couple. They were a middle-class couple, so there seemed to be... on the grounds of Calvary Episcopal Church, which is a huge, takes up essentially a city block, if you include its parking lot. And it had been open to everybody, including the homeless community, and it now is being closed down. There's a story in this week's, used to be called the Metro, what is it called now, the Santa Cruz Weekly, I think it's called. It's called After the Shit Storm, although there... It's SH*T storm. We don't get to say poo-poo words, either in print or on the air, unless you're in pirate radio, in which case we have people talking about all kinds of strange things on the air here. So the issue was, for me, the issue is discrimination by businesses, by churches, by the government authorities in public spaces in and around Santa Cruz. And that actually is what we were protesting last week in front of Bunny's Shoes. Bunny's is one of the four businesses that signed declarations against two homeless musicians, Ana and Miguel, Ana Richardson and Miguel De Leon, whose crime and what they were enjoined from doing because they had done it so many times was sleeping outside downtown. You might say, well, here we have a visitor from New York. She might say, well, you know, I mean, why should people sleep outside downtown? That's kind of, you know, grubby and seedy and squalid and, you know, might be unsightly. I'm not sure if you would say that. You wouldn't say that. What do you mean you wouldn't say? Are you crazy? I'm not going to get into this at this time. No, I mean, I wouldn't say it either, obviously. But, you know, the reality is in Santa Cruz, there's no legal place for people to sleep at night. And throughout the entire city limits on all public property, it is equally criminal after 11 o'clock to fall asleep or to cover up with blankets. So some of the protesting we're doing every Saturday, and we'll be doing it again this Saturday at 1 o'clock in front of Bunny's Shoes, come on down, is to encourage the community to change this law, not by the futile method of going to the city council and saying, oh, please, please grant us our civil rights, thank you so much, which they haven't done, and although we've made such representations year after year and decade after decade, but rather it is to go to the consumers downtown and say, here's a pledge about ending the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. Not everywhere and anywhere, but somewhere. There have to be legal places for people to sleep. We're asking merchants to put a little thing in their window saying, we support human rights for homeless people and the right to sleep somewhere. We encourage you to patronize those businesses that have this in their window, and if they don't, you know, go ask them why they don't. I mean, if you know, if you're, you know, saying, I'd like to buy from your store, but I notice you don't seem to, you know, favor, or at least you're not willing to post something that says you favor human rights for homeless people of the most basic kind. Because if you can't sleep at night, there's not much, you know, kind of interferes with the rest of your business. In fact, it may drive you crazy and cause you to suffer other disabilities. So this is what this discussion is about, which we were having a meeting on the grass at Calvary Episcopal Church, which is every Monday they have a church coffee house there. And we were trying to meet before the coffee house so as not to be interfering with anything that was going on. It turned out that we were in conflict scheduling with the woman who was running the coffee house, a sweet woman who's really been trying to do a lot of good work, opening up the grounds to people even when the church has now declared it's closed. You can't loiter there except on Wednesday afternoons and Monday afternoons. So we didn't want to interfere with her Bible studies, but you know, the meeting was there. We had scheduled it. We didn't know it was happening simultaneously. We moved it away slightly so that it wouldn't interfere, and yet at the same time, the Reverend Joel Miller came out and told us, "We're calling the police unless you leave." So we moved onto the sidewalk, and you know, after some, frankly, some indignation from me, because I'm wondering what a church is doing, telling the people that they're supposedly their flock, that are trying to organize peaceful protests downtown to restore human rights for people, that they can't be there, even though they're not disturbing anything. So it's that which happened. Actually, it's about an hour beyond this tape you're hearing, but you're going to hear some talk, some discussion of experiences homeless people have had suffering this kind of treatment individually. And it's actually much better when they try to do this to you in a group, because as a group, you can stand up and speak back. You may choose to, as we did, to go off the lawn and stay on the sidewalk, even though it's not much room to meet on the Santa Cruz sidewalk. We did it anyway because, you know, even though there's a spacious, grassy area, if somebody wants to claim it's suddenly their private property and their congregation is not going to be allowed to be there, they have, you know, the right as a private citizen to do that. It seems to conflict with the mission of their church. It seems to be a form of hypocrisy, but hypocrisy is nothing new here in Santa Cruz. Here, let's hear a little more of the interview.
Now, we have another man next to you with a big white piece of tarp, tent,
white canopy.
It's a canopy, and you're also laying out your blanket on the sidewalk. Are you planning to this is sort of a religious ritual? Yeah, people can take off their shoes and walk on your blanket.
Yes. They may as much as they would like. Actually, what I'm doing is adding some sunlight to my blanket. It makes everything smell fresher.
I see. Now, what is your name, Sunshine Man?
My name is Logan.
And, Logan, you say that you yourself have gotten a citation recently?
I just got my first citation in California.
How did that happen?
Well, I was out in the Poconos cleaning up various trash particles, like this blanket and tarp and sleeping bag and coat.
Cleaning up, meaning you found these and are cleaning them up, or you're picking them up from, you put them down there? Or?
Yeah, I was picking a friend's camp up, what was left. And I went and had my two beers stashed there for almost a month, came back down, and as I was coming down the hill with my little skate, I fell down and broke a beer bottle open.
Oh, beer. Well, beer bottle or beer can?
It was beer bottle.
Did you hurt yourself?
No injuries attained. But, so I sat there and finished my beer, where the park ranger then informed me that I was in a park, and breaking the law, and then wrote me a citation.
For?
Open, intox, and possession of alcohol.
Well, you're allowed to possess alcohol. Was your container open? Your other container?
My other container, the one that I had not been drinking, was still closed, but the one that I fell down and broke open was open.
Well, that, were you then carrying the open, broken container, or were you, what happened?
I finished it.
Yeah.
How are you doing today?
Good.
Go ahead.
I finished it and got the citation.
Who was the person who cited you?
I do not have the ranger's name. I have the ticket, though.
Okay, let's take a look. Hi, I'm Robert.
Hello, Robert. I heard of you. I'm Father Miller.
How do you do, Father Miller?
This is kind of ironic. This is the man who called the police on me an hour and a half later because we were holding a meeting and said, he said, you have to leave immediately. And I said, why? And he just said, we're calling the police. It's unfortunate that kind of ultimatum has to be given. And I'm hoping that kind of thing changes in Santa Cruz because, first of all, it makes for bad feelings. Second of all, it seems to me, though you might say that a person is within their rights to claim vast amounts of property and exclude the public from it or parts of the public from it, it may be something that the rest of the public would look at, and I'm hoping they're doing this downtown to businesses that don't support basic homeless rights, and say, we don't want to have any part of this kind of bigoted attitude. It's just wrong. And it's wrong for the church to be closing its property of 5 days a week to people. Unless they're engaging in illegal behavior or abusive behavior or causing serious problems. Now, there have been some problems that have been mentioned, like marijuana smoking, as though that was some huge problem has been mentioned. There have been a couple of other things. But, I think if you're in a community where a lot of people are homeless, whether these are hard economic times, and we didn't talk about that, Linda, Andre here is still in the studio with me. Let me just throw a question at you, Linda, because it's come at me as I'm... Yeah, it's you. I'm talking to you. Yeah, I'm talking to you, woman. Does the economic situation have anything to do with, upsurges in shock treatment or... Does this have an economic dimension in another way? Is this sort of a treatment that only, mostly either well-to-do people or people who are, government-funded get? Are poor people likely to be put into a shock treatment situation? Not so much in Santa Cruz. It's not used here that much in this county. But let's say where you come from. You're from New York City?
Yeah.
Manhattan or?
Yeah.
So I know that Giuliani and... what's his name? Beerbaum, Ballbottom, Blumberg, Boomy, whatever his name is.
Bloomberg,
yes. There's been this great cleanup activity where human beings are treated like bags of garbage and removed. Do poor people have this problem with ECT as much as rich people? Is there an economic factor?
Well, insurance.
ECT is shock therapy, by the way.
Insurance is an economic factor, and if you've got Medicaid or Medicare, public insurance, that will pay for shock treatment without question, as does most private insurance. To some extent, the more powerless somebody is, the more likely they're to get shock. And I say this because most people who get shock are women, something like 75% are women, and most are elderly. So if you combine those two, you've got elderly women, which are pretty much the most powerless, invisible people that we've got in our society. I don't know about New York, because we don't have statistics, but in Texas, which is a state which does keep statistics on shock treatment, they found that people became hundreds of times more likely to get shock treatment once they turned 65. Well, why was that? That's because they got their Medicare, and Medicare pays for shock treatment, no questions asked. So that's another reason why the elderly are more likely to get shocked. The more female you are and the older you are, the more likely.
Well, the solution is simple. You simply don't get old and you change your gender. So I don't know.
Well, I'd like to do that.
Yeah. Well, I can't really help you at this time with that particular problem. In the studio with us is Linda Andre, author of Doctors of Deception. In case you didn't hear earlier, she is peddling her book around town. Or actually, unfortunately, she's not. I guess she's leaving town shortly. But you can ask for it, Doctors of Deception, and go online and get it. You can Google for Linda Andre, and maybe you can get in touch with her that way. Or give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's my off-air number. I will pass on any comments from all of you folks too timid to call in or possibly afraid there's a psychiatrist lurking behind the mic here. I will keep an eye on you, and we may need to shock you later. I make jokes about this because I frankly think it's too serious a subject to take seriously, frankly. I mean, I don't want to feel weighed down with all this stuff because it is so serious that, and there is so little, as you were saying, Linda, on the break, you know, you're listening, nobody's listening to us. What can we do about it? It feels futile. But you obviously don't think it's futile. You wrote this book, and you're not going to make a mint off this book, I don't think. But you regard that probably as a useful thing to have written, no? She's pausing, folks. Maybe not.
It was an activity of my nature, as Marx would say. It was something that I had to do, and I'm sure I'm not going to make any money off it whatsoever. I mean, it would be nice to be paid for my labor, but that wasn't why I did it.
Well, I was asking you, though, do you feel that you're glad it was done?
Am I glad it was done?
Do you feel
done?
Good that this is here in front of people? Or do you think, ugh.
It's better that it be
think,
here.
You know.
It's much better that it be here than that it not be here. On the other hand, I would much rather not have written it because then I wouldn't have gotten shocked.
And you'd have memory of those 5 years that you're missing.
Yeah.
Continuing with some more interviews from the street, you can call in 427-3772.
This is free radio. I'm doing some interviews.
Okay, very good.
What you got here?
John Wallace?
Yes, Chief Ranger John Wallace. He's well known as a man who's very, very, well, should we say, prolific in his giving of tickets.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
But, you know, you're not really guilty of a crime if you accidentally broke open a bottle of beer because you fell down. Your open container law has to do is if you have voluntarily picked up an open container or you've opened your own container. In other words, it sounds like an accident that happened. I mean, did you possess it for a period of time after it was open, or what were you trying to do?
I had it open for about 2 minutes, and then it was empty.
And where was Ranger Wallace when all this happened?
I believe he was right at the beginning of the park, like right as you come up to the gate.
How far away from were you?
75 yards.
Right. And did you explain to him what happened?
I was a little bit dazzled at the moment. You know, that kind of caught me off guard.
What did he say to you?
Do you know it's illegal to be possessing an open container in a park?
Or in Santa Cruz, for that matter, on any public property.
Yeah, I didn't realize that it was in a park. I thought it was the mountains, you know.
Yeah, no, wow. Poganup, of course, is a large park in the city limits, Greenbelt area. Closes at night. Don't you sleep there. You'll be under arrest.
Don't sleep there. Naughty, naughty.
Okay. Now, I see that... I should warn you about this citation that you are... will not appear probably in the court until a month from now. So,
and I'm giving him the standard warning that these tickets, they're slow in the court, so you don't have to pay attention for about a month. On the line, however, with me is that mediator among mediators, the infamous Big Drum Brent, as I call him, the man who successfully has, shall we say, coaxed Sergeant Harms to become less harmful at the Drum Circle, who helped to, and you're helping with a number of other projects, among them being the Street Performers Guild, which I guess is formed to try to stop police abuses and merchant nonsense against street performers in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, that's right. We're really just trying to seek some common ground to improve the atmosphere for street musicians and brace yourself to make the business climate for the downtown businesses even better than it already is. We want to put a smile on everybody's face.
Gag me, big boy. Go ahead.
So the meeting went well. 10 people showed up of the 15 people we invited. This was the small tent meeting, as we call it, for the new Santa Cruz Street Performers Guild. Is our very first meeting. We're going to have the larger tent meeting when everybody's invited. We just kind of wanted to have a small kickoff and get announce ourselves without a lot of discussion necessarily. Really, we just wanted to lord over people and tell them what our ideas were.
Of course. You authoritarian dog, you.
So we shared a little bit of our history because it was started in the early 80s and was instrumental in the voluntary guidelines.
Instrumental, is that a little pun there, Brett?
I'm not that bright. That's great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Shared that the history of how successful the voluntary guidelines were. They lasted for 23 years.
And, of course, for those who don't know, voluntary guidelines are the guidelines that said, essentially, you can play until somebody comes along and says, hey, I'd like this space, or else the merchant says, I'm really tired of hearing that same tune again and again, or, you know, somebody says, hey, I want to, you know, hacky sack here for a while, or whatever, and then you have an hour, and you're supposed to leave, and it's a voluntary agreement. It doesn't involve the law. You can say, fuck you, it's my free speech right, I've got a right to be here, and the person, you know, but there's a peer pressure to respond to that.
That's right. It's a gentle person's agreement that protects the businesses as well as the performers.
It was destroyed, of course, by Ed Porter and Emily Riley and other members of the city council in 2002. It actually was destroyed in 1994, but
yeah.
Tom Noddy did a quick little patch-up deal that kind of delayed the destruction. That's the way I viewed it. But they passed the initial set of downtown ordinances in 94 that essentially gave the police broad powers to selectively enforce and remove people for spare changing, street performing, sitting,
right,
or political tabling. And that has become worse and worse with each successive round of ordinance tightenings that they do.
Yeah, that's right. And then the 2002 change-up hinted at was that they specifically cited street musicians and drew up definite laws defining distances to and from what you can be in proximity of. Pardon my grammar, I'm a little out of it. And they also included the 1 hour limitation, but it's a little vague there. Not being a gentle person's agreement, it's more like kind of they use it to make us go away whenever they want to. Actually, the reason that the guild is coming back into existence is because of the misuse of the laws by the police department and the soon-to-be disappeared host. They're going away, I hear. But the cops are kind of, instead of using the downtown ordinances for the street musicians, they use this noise ordinance thing instead. It's superseding the whole thing, and then they use it improperly. I'll go and talk to the business who has called the police officer and find out what really the problem had been, and it'll have nothing to do with the noise ordinance. So we're being really, really, I don't know what the term would be, the police are misusing the laws.
Have you got, you know, a lawyer kind of on board to give you some legal opinions? Because I know you and I have talked a lot, and I've criticized as completely unworkable the unreasonable noise ordinance simply because it's so badly written that it can't really be used for anything if you look at the actual wording of the ordinance.
Yeah.
And we talked about this on the air. But, you know, obviously they have been using it quite freely over the last three or four decades, which is when it's been on the books. I'm not quite sure when they did it, when it was passed. So you might want to check with an attorney to make sure that, you know, our analysis is, you know, the analysis of some neutral party as well, because, you know, it would be kind of unfortunate for you to do all this work and then have some, you know, John Barisoni look at you and sneer and,
yeah,
you know, go the other. He's our city attorney. Go the way.
Yeah, I take that. That's right. We'll have to actually, you know, if we plan on some sort of arrest activism or something like that, where we challenge these, we'll really have to bone up and really know what we're doing. But we definitely know that
that when we check on these noise ordinance complaints, they're not about what the word of the noise ordinance is at all. They're using it as a move along thing, whereas that's not. I mean, we already have a new move along law. Just mark us, and then we'll play for an hour, and then we'll be gone within the hour.
Which is ridiculous in and of itself.
Sure, the guideline, but the voluntary guidelines, and that's kind of like, anyway. But now they're using the noise ordinance as a threat of taking you to jail if you don't stop. It's just and that effect is driving away some of the better musicians, or even the softer musicians. If you go out and you want to share your creation or your art or sing for the people downtown, and a police comes up to you, most people just feel like they don't want to encounter that again, and it kind of like scares them off. So really, these laws, the way they're being used in the police department, is killing the creative spirit downtown, and that's what kind of.
I've heard a number of performers who will not come back downtown. I say this based upon specific discussions with specific people. I mean, I'm of course trying to encourage police not to behave as they do, and encouraging that's a hopeless thing. What we need to do is encourage the community not to allow the police to do that, and that's really our only answer. But I think it's also true that this kind of behavior by the police has resulted, and I've gotten specific accounts of people saying, I'm not going to come down and play anymore because I don't want to be harassed or face the prospect of harassment. And it's, of course, your Street Performers Guild is going to have to stand up to harassment. And I understand that, you're planning to go to the Downtown Association on Tuesday morning to talk to the Chip and his gang of business associates.
We're on the schedule to make a presentation, which will be our formal introduction to them.
Don't sell out the baby on the first presentation, please.
Okay, that's right. I'm actually in the process of writing up a little flyer right now, and I want to be delicate with it. I don't want to hammer them. This is the common.
Why not? They're acting like a bunch of criminal assholes.
This is the common
to cut down culture in Santa Cruz. If you don't tell them where it's at,
well, see,
I don't know.
This is what we're learning, though, Robert. You and I presently about creating common ground so people feel heard. Because imagine these businesses, of course. They seem to be calling freely and killing the creative spirit downtown, and it directly negatively reflects on their business, their sales, because people are not coming downtown as much. Hey, we don't feel that lively, artful spirit that we used to have. We're not going down there anymore. People say that, when they want to come out from Monterey.
There is an argument for that, but I think, as I've said this to you before, and I say this to other street performers, unless you get together a lot of street performers and supporters.
Yeah.
First, before you attempt to start dickering with the, I don't want to say dickering with the dickheads. That sounds a little hostile.
Gay.
I don't know if it's gay. Dickhead is not gay.
Right.
It's more a form of abuse.
Well,
Dick Tracy's. The people who use police instead of using reasonable discussions with people about sharing common space and recognizing that public spaces are not commercial campgrounds where they can simply plant their huge footstep just whatever the hell they want. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
My point is.
Yes.
We're learning to create common ground, which means, okay, first of all, these businesses, they're highly invested, right? Their money, their time, their lives, their livelihood, that's why they're profoundly defensive, offensive even. And so, we want to, when we interact with them, as street performers or as the guild, we're meeting with them on their turf at the Downtown Business Association. We really want to have them feel heard. And that way, that'll open up a space for them to hear us.
Have you been listening, by the way, to our show about psychiatric ECT abuse, electroshock problems?
What?
Yeah. In the studio with me, I'll introduce you to our Linda Saylor.
Oh, that's right. I was listening a little of that. Thank you.
Yeah, you did hear that.
Yeah, I heard about – I just got off work, so I heard about it.
Trying to talk to business owners about the rights of street performers is similar to trying to talk to psychiatrists about the dangers of ECT.
Well,
and I'll tell you the reason I say that. I don't think there is a really rational concern behind what business owners do. They claim there is.
Yeah, they're
just
trying
the
to make money.
Psychiatrists will claim there is, that they're really helping their patients.
They're trying to make money.
Yeah, well, they're trying to make money, but they're saying more, oh, it's bad behavior downtown. It's these, you know, performers who are driving, bad performers, and it's the panhandlers. And they're going to use a whole series of bigoted arguments that don't really have a lot to do. If you look at the, I mean, if you ever can find the stats, it's kind of hard to find stats. You know, Linda's been talking
I actually am starting to believe them, because it's almost like this craze that's sweeping the nation over the last few years, what's it called now? Forgive me. The law of attraction. The more they look at this negative experience, the more they see it, and they are actually creating it with these laws and with the style of policing. And we are seeing a more edgier, sort of grittier feel downtown that is not conducive to the. It's not the Santa Cruz that we know and love anymore. The tactic of confrontation and getting a bunch of musicians together and ramming this message up their ass, in my opinion, let's use this as a verb. Let's Obama the situation. Create some common ground.
You mean send some people to Pakistan to further the war there? You mean that sort of thing? Right. I think it's important. You use the metaphor about Obama, and I think Obama is a good metaphor here, because I think you're going to get a lot of bullshit response, and the same problems are going to continue unless you have some power behind you.
I'm talking about his style as a community organizer, not what he's done.
He hasn't done any community organizing in many years.
I know that, but all I'm saying is something I learned that why he was highly successful is this creating common ground between two opposing sides. That are just not working together.
I can't really argue about Obama, but I'm suspicious of such claims, frankly.
So what I'd like to do is get encouraged by helping the businesses downtown feel heard for a few moments. But when we make our presentation, we really just want to let them see that we care about the same things that they care about downtown. We want a safe environment. We actually want to... kind of help them. I mean, we would like we think that a vibrant street performer community and freedom down there would actually help their businesses, and we think we can convince them of that.
Uh-huh. Well, I wish you luck in that task, and I certainly want to hear about all the great changes that they're willing to make once you've presented this to them. I do think that your real task is getting together supporters, not trying to persuade
right.
hardened bigots who have been doing this for years. And these are people who on national issues are very liberal, you know.
Yeah.
Coonerty, you know, he wants to save this and save that, and I'm talking about Ryan Coonerty, the former mayor and council member, and Neil Coonerty, the supervisor. But the problem is, these are business people whose ultimate bottom line has to do with a whole mindset that it's not possible to change with a 10-minute
right.
presentation.
Well, I will tell you what. Okay, that's just the presentation. That's not what the Guild is doing. Let me be really
yeah.
quickly.
What's the Guild up to?
What we're really doing is encouraging street performers when they have a cop interaction that doesn't go so well or whatever. Remember, and you know this more than any of us. This is kind of your thing. Get that police officer's name, and then really try to chronicle or write, take a note about what he says you're doing wrong, where exactly downtown that is taking place, and then let's create a database of all this interaction. We are starting to do that now. That
That's
way,
a good idea.
We
I
can go
with
directly
that.
With the police department as the Guild, as a force of to be reckoned with, instead of all these individuals who, you know, these stories just get lost.
Sure,
you know?
And call over witnesses and have a tape recorder if you can. And,
yeah, and then
you know,
so we'll be able to go,
sergeant
like, look,
and so
this officer five times has used this ordinance incorrectly, or this host is totally misusing these laws and scaring these people away. We've been playing down there for years, and we've been faced with this noise ordinance incorrectly, I have to say, at least 50 times in the last 2 years alone.
Really?
Yeah, it's been really disheartening, and it makes us, you know, you kind of do feel a little militant. Luckily, we have thick skin, and that's kind of about what our act is about. We really just kind of keep pounding it out, and we almost thrive on it. But I know that a lot of the softer musicians, they don't come out anymore. Santa Cruz is getting this reputation on the troubadour circuit that people just stay away from Santa Cruz. We're not getting any more of those.
Well, I think that, that may be what some you know, some businesses want. But, you know, Brent, are you going to be coming to the Bunny Shoes protest at 1 o'clock on Saturday?
I'm going to be at a festival out of town.
You'll be at a festival. Okay, well, we'll try to carry on. We only have about 10 minutes left.
Thank you.
And when's the next meeting that people actually can... And is there a contact point where if they do have a problem with a police officer in terms of street performing?
Oh, yeah, please. We're going to have to get a more focused one. For right now, if you're a street musician or anybody downtown, of course, always interact and share your information with Robert Norris.
That's me.
But you can email me. My name is Brent at compassionman@hotmail.com. That's compassionman@hotmail.com. And, yeah. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you, Brent.
Much love and support to you,
and
Robert.
Give us an announcement when you're actually going to have another meeting.
Yeah, we haven't decided that yet. It'll be in early July, and then everyone will be invited, even you.
Oh, really? I wouldn't do that if I were you. Take care.
Be well.
Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. In the studio with me is author Linda Andre, Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment, and what she has not forgotten, in spite of the fact that they cut 5 years out of her head and heart, and that's eloquently described in the first few chapters of this book. I actually had a few questions for you that I wrote up before the show, which I'll run my mouth for a moment or two. What's not in this book that was likely to be in the next one if you were to write a next book?
I am not writing another book about shock treatment.
Oh, come on. Now, what about the... We don't know about the
no, you
national
ask,
scene. We've already found
you
out
cannot
your
ask
abysmal
that of anybody.
Ignorance on
you
that
cannot
particular...
cannot ask that of anyone, please. Yeah. No, my next book is going to be all about surfing.
You are a surfer.
Sort of.
Uh-huh. Should we call you the psychotic surfer?
See, that's not funny.
I know, it's not. No, it's not.
Nope.
And, in fact, I have been criticized by making those kinds of jokes on the air by activists like Jane and Sylvia.
Yeah, right.
Who invited you to the studio, or invited you to brave me in the studio. How critics, have you gotten any critics who've reacted to this book who said, what a bad book you've written, I don't like it?
I wish. I did get a letter from a local psychiatrist. Forget his name, though. I've got the letter here. I think his name was Gillette. Anyway, he had not read the book at all, but he was just outraged that I was going to talk about it. How dare I write a book with a title like Doctors of Deception? Why this book could not be any good, and who was I to even say anything about doctors? Who was I? But no.
There's nothing substantive in what he...
No, it was just rhetoric, so... Gee, I'd welcome some criticism.
What you mentioned Leonard Frank's earlier history of shock therapy. He's a guy who himself was shocked in the early 60s, or maybe late 50s, I'm not sure. And he writes regularly for Street Spirit, the newspaper that homeless people can distribute on the streets of Santa Cruz and other cities and make some, you know, coffee change for. You can sell them for a buck, and if you want to get in touch with me, you come to the Huff meeting, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, you can grab a bunch of these papers and go sell them, you know, and we don't get any money from it, you do. So, you know, I encourage you to do that. Huff meets every Wednesday at 9:30 and at the Sub Rosa Cafe, that's on Pacific Avenue at Spruce, I think is the cross street, block from Laurel. 9:30 to 11:30 on Wednesday. You can sell Street Spirit. Leonard Frank is a guy who has a regular column there, kind of wise sayings of different kind, quotations. He's into the quotations. He's written a number of books, one of them about the history of shock therapy that predates your book. And I think there's some earlier works. I showed you a book that you said you'd read about, I guess, women in the asylum or writings from the asylum. And there's been some... I was going to actually mention this to you. The media does not view shock therapy in a very positive way. I've never seen a movie with a positive treatment of shock therapy. There's, you know, a lot of negative stuff about, you know, people who've had shock therapy stars. At least put it this way. The movies I've seen that involve shock therapy don't talk about, well, she had shock therapy and now she's all better. It's more like this, the coercion. It's part of a general impression that this is part of the, I think a true impression of the coercive aspect of psychiatry. You know what I'm talking about? The names of these movies are not on the tip of my... I think Frances Farmer was one person that mm-hmm. had a movie done about her, which was a very positive treatment of her and a negative treatment of what happened to her. And that's happened to about a couple of other famous people who are described as victims. Of course, it's portrayed as the old medieval psychiatry
right.
that is no longer with us. But shock therapy, I guess that they've been trying to rejuvenate it, repackage it, you know, bring it to fluff it up and frill it out and so forth. Have they been successful in, you know, in terms of the national media, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think they have.
Completely.
Because no one's come to me and said, shock therapy, you know, I'm off to get it. You know, I mean, I haven't, I guess I'm in the wrong circles. I don't. I was going to try to present some, ask you about whether there were any positive accounts of shock therapy other than Kitty Dukakis or people funded by the pharmaceuticals that you've heard from or heard about. And I think I asked you that question already, and you said you probably hadn't, right?
Well, first you were talking about fiction. Now you're talking about nonfiction, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, there are other ones. There are.
People who felt that they benefited from shock therapy.
There are a few, but they tend to be written by professionals, strangely enough.
Who have had that experience themselves.
Yeah, but who also happen to be professionals. There's just a couple I can think of.
Are they mentioned in your book?
No. One was a psychiatrist, and one was a psychologist, I think.
Interesting. If we ever do a follow-up by email, maybe I'll ask you some questions about that. Have you had any contact with people like Zaz on this issue? Thomas Zaz, who's written a lot on that. You know, his first seminal book was The Myth of Mental Illness. I'm sure you've read his stuff.
No, I haven't.
Well, get busy. I want more details, or at least I want to hear more contact. And a lot of these questions I have here I've already asked you. You know, you were denied a debate. Whitaker was denied a debate. What do you do with people come and say, I've got a mental health problem, and my doctor says I should go shock myself? You know, we've already talked about that. What's the extent of involuntary outpatient treatment, forced drugging, needles on wheels, as we call it, in New York these days? Kindra's law, you know.
Actually, I don't know the answer to that question.
I appreciate your candor. That'll be your third book. Exposing.
No.
You're not going to write another book on that subject. Okay, hopefully that'll be somebody's third book or somebody's next book. This is a good start, and I encourage people to check out Doctors of Deception by Linda Andre. I'm going to be going off to San Francisco tomorrow, where I have a hearing in the federal court before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Actually, I don't. It's my attorneys are going to be babbling away, claiming, as I think any fool can see, that raising your arm silently in a mock Nazi salute, in a way, in essence, is saying that the city council is acting like a bunch of fascists when they threaten to arrest a peace activist at the mic for trying to speak for her 2 minutes there, as the mayor did in 2002, and then threatening me with arrest if I don't leave the chambers, and when I refused to leave, I was arrested, handcuffed, taken to jail. No charges were brought, of course. It was all dropped. We've sued them. It's going back to federal court. It'll be argued tomorrow at 2:30 in San Francisco, and I'll be going up there to watch this little spectacle continue. I'll give you another report. We'll probably not hear anything for another 9 months. But there will be something more that you can participate in actively, those who are out there who want to stand up for the rights of poor people. That has to do with what I mentioned before, Bunny's Shoes, a protest in front of Bunny's Shoes. We're going to be continuing the attempt to get merchants to sign a pledge to put in their window simply a little kind of statement, we favor homeless rights, and we think we favor the right to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. And that... We've gotten two stores at least to put them up, and a number of other stores are considering it. And we're trying to suggest to people that if this is in the window, people should consider patronizing those stores. And if it's not, they should ask some questions. I see some strangers in the studio, or I should say they're stranger and stranger. And it's time for me to say happy trails. I want to thank you for being with me and with Linda. Linda, thank you for enduring the two-hour marathon here.
You're welcome.
As well as the bathroom, which you won't get into. I love talking about that bathroom. One of these days I'm going to have to go in there with a mop. In any case, I'll be back on Sunday. I'll be down at Bunny Shoes on Saturday at 1 o'clock, and I encourage you to come down there, too. That's near the Palomar/Coffee Roasting Company area. Again, the point is to restore civil rights for homeless people in Santa Cruz. Thanks for being with me in this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside. I'll be back on Sunday, and that'll be at 9:30 in the morning. You can reach Linda by Googling for Doctors of Deception. Any final words, Linda?
People could email if they want to do that at CTIP, like Committee for Truth in Psychiatry, at RCN, like Nancy.com. Or write P.O. Box 1214, New York, New York, 10003. That's for Committee for Truth in Psychiatry.
Thanks.
Welcome to From the Cream to the Dregs with Uncle Dennis. I am actually in the studio, but the show you will be hearing tonight was recorded a couple of years ago by my youngest son and his friends. It's called The Kids Show. It has a lot of different music in it. I'm actually on vacation, but the alternate programmer I had scheduled to come in tonight has had some hard times and personal tragedy, and maybe she'll make it in another time. But anyway, tonight I'm going to get things started for you here with The Boys Show from July of 2007. I hope you enjoy it. Of course, the Hour of Slack will be on at 11 o'clock, and following that, our usual agglomeration of assorted shows for better or for worse. So thank you for listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Tune in next weekend at next week, Thursday night at 8 o'clock, and we will have a full live version of From the Cream to the Dregs. See you then. Bye. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. That was Houses in Motion by the Talking Heads. Next, we will be playing, it's not from the 60s or 70s, but it's some early hip-hop. It's called Lottie Dottie by Slick Rick. The album's Live 85.
Okay, party people in the house. You're about to witness something you've never witnessed before. Yes, it's the original human beatbox, Dougie Fresh, and his partner, the Grand Wizard, MC Ricky D. D, and that's me in the place to be. And we're going to show you how we do it for 85 Kick It Live, all right? Because I got a funny feeling you're all sick of all these crab rappers biting their rhymes because I'm their backstabbers. But when it comes to me and my friend Doug Fresh here, there is no competition because we are the best, yeah. Finesse and press, which we prove. And y'all will realize that we are the move. So listen close, so you all don't miss. As we go a little something like this. Hit it! Oh, yeah. You know what? Lottie Dottie. Lottie Dottie. Lottie. Lottie. You know what? Yo, peep this. Lottie Dottie. We like to party. We don't cause trouble. We don't bother nobody. We're just the men that's on the mic. And when we rock up on the mic, we rock the mic. What? For all of y'all, keeping y'all in health, just to see you smile and enjoy yourself. Cause it's cool when you cause a cozy condition, and that we create, cause that's our mission. So listen to what we say, because this type of shit, it happens every day. I woke up around 10 o'clock in the morning. I gave myself a stretcher, a morning yawning. Went to the bathroom to wash up, had some soap on my face and my hand upon a cup. I said, mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the top choice of them all? There was a rumble dumble. 5 minutes it lasted. The mirror said,
"You are, you conceited bastard."
Well, that's true. That's why we never have no beef. So then I washed off the soap and brushed the gold teeth. Used oil of Olay because my skin gets pale. And then I got the files for my fingernails. Due to the night and on my behalf, I put the bubbles in the tub so I could have a bubble bath. Clean, dry was my body and hair. I threw on my brand new Gucci underwear. For all the girls I might take home, I got the Johnson's baby powder and the Polo cologne. Fresh dress like a million bucks. Threw on the balcony shoes and the fly green socks. Stepped out my house, stopped short. Oh no, I went back in. I forgot my Kango, and then I dilly
Sally.
I ran through her. I bumped into my old girl
Sally.
From the
Sally.
This is a girl plays hard to get. So I said, "What's wrong?" Cause she looked upset. She said, "It's all because of you. I'm feeling sad and blue. You went away, and now my life is filled with rainy days. And I love you so, how much you'll never know. Cause you took your love away from me." Now, what was I to do? Just crying over me, and she was feeling blue. I said, "Don't cry, dry your eye. Here comes your mother with those two little guys." Her mean mother stepped up, said to me,
"Hi."
Looked Sally in the face and decked her in the
eye.
Punched her in the belly and stepped on her
feet.
Slammed the child on the hard concrete. The bitch was strong, the kids was gone. Something was wrong. I said, "What is going on?" I tried to break it up. I said, "Stop it, leave her." She said, "If I can't have you, she can't either." She grabbed me closely by my socks, so I broke the hell out like I had the chicken pox. But she gave chase, she caught up quick. She put a finger in the face of MC Rick. She said, "Why don't you give me a plane so we can go cruising in my OJ? And if you give me that okay, I give you all my love today." Ricky, 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 can't you see? Somehow your words just hypnotize me, and I just love your jazzy ways. Oh, MC Rick, my love is here to stay. And on and on and on she kept on. The bitch been around before my mother's born. I said, "Cheer up." I gave her a kiss. I said, "You can't have me. I'm too young for you, miss." She says, "No, you're not." Then she starts crying. I says, "I'm 19. She said,
"Stop lying."
I says, "I am. Go ask my mother. And with your wrinkled pussy, I can't be your lover." To the tick-tock, you don't stop. To the tick-tick, and you don't quit. Hit it!
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.